Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a Federalist Society podcast. I'm Elizabeth Slattery, Vice President of Practice Groups. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you won't miss an episode. Now please enjoy today's conversation.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar. Today, July 29th, 2026, we are delighted to host a conversation entitled Criminal Law and Procedure at the Supreme Court, a Recap of OT25. My name is Emma Blakemore, and I'm an Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, as the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. In the interest of time, I'll keep the introductions brief, but if you would like to know more about any of our panelists, you can access their impressive full bios at fedsoc.org. Today, we are fortunate to have Matthew P. Cavadon and Kent Scheidegger as our panelists, with Mark Levin as our moderator. Mr. Cavadon is director of the Project on Criminal Justice at the Cato Institute. Mr. Scheidegger is legal director and general counsel at the Criminal Justice Legal Foundation. And Mr. Levin is chief policy counsel for the Council on Criminal Justice and senior advisor for Right on Crime. And I will leave it there. One last note throughout the panel, if you have any questions, please submit them through the question and answer feature so that we will have access to them when we get to that portion of the webinar. We do ask that questions submitted there both pertain to this discussion and end with a question mark. And so with that, thank you for being with us today. And I will turn things over to Mr. Levin to start the conversation.
Thank you. We're really excited to be discussing the Supreme Court term that just concluded as it relates to criminal justice and four specific areas that really are very interesting. First of all, privacy in the digital age, then the geography of federal prosecution, the machinery of capital sentencing, and the limits that may exist in terms of plea bargains. Defendants to give up their right to appeal. And so these were addressed in four decisions. The first one, which is probably the one that's gotten the most attention, is Chatry versus United States. And this was a 6-3 decision by the court that's held obtaining a person's cell phone location history through a warrant is in fact a Fourth Amendment search. And Justice Kagan wrote that decision for the court. There was a notable concurrence by Justice Gorsuch that really used different reasoning that would have a potentially different impact in future cases, as well as a pointed dissent by Justice Alito, joined in part by Justices Thomas and Barrett. Then the other case we're going to look at today is Abuamo versus United States. And that was a unanimous court concluding through an opinion by Justice Kagan that venue for document falsification charges under Section 15 belonged where the falsification occurred, not where the investigation was conducted. And the decision declined to let us the intent element of that statute stretch venue to the place of where the offense, not where it actually occurred. Then there's Ham versus Smith, and this one was kind of a non-event in some ways, but does have some future implications that we'll get into. But Smith is improvidently granted this capital case out of Alabama that dealt with an individual with a low IQ score who was set to be executed. And the 11th Circuit had stopped that execution, and which will remain stopped after this 5-4 decision not to take that up. And then finally, Hunter versus United States. And in that decision, the court affirmed that appeal waivers are generally enforceable, but there's a narrow exemption for miscarriage of justice that would apply to egregious sentencing errors that would bring the whole system into disrepute. And so where that line is be an issue going forward. So what we're going to do is not necessarily spend the time on all these cases. I think both Matthew and Kent are most focused on different ones, which I think will be really complimentary for our discussion. And of course, we'll have the Q&A time as well. And I did want to finally note, we'll look forward a bit to the term coming up. And of course, cases are still being we do know will be on the agenda is one called Jopi versus Alaska. And I'm probably getting that pronunciation wrong, but this is a civil asset forfeiture dispute that's gotten a lot of attention recently with the Institute for Justice being involved. But an 82-year-old Bush pilot's airplane was seized after alcohol was found and the plane was going into a dry village. So this seems like a rather disproportionate forfeiture that we'll talk about later. But with all that being said, I wanted to turn now to Matthew as our first presenter to address the four cases we talked about, and again, not necessarily spend an equal amount of time on each one, but really Cato has done important work in many areas, including privacy and individual rights. So I look forward to your comments.
We did chime in with amicus briefs in the Hunter case, the Chatry case, and the Abu Ammo case. So three out of those four, Ham being the exception, we did weigh in. So thank you very much for the introduction, Mark, and thank you very much to everybody for attending today. Let me spend a couple of minutes just kind of flying through the various cases that you mentioned. So first up is Chatry. I guess I'll start with the big one here. So there was a robbery at a federal credit union in Virginia. Police did not know who the suspect might be, so they requested that Google hand over three different stages of information to them. In stage one, and I should say that they got one warrant for all three of these phases and relied on that for each of these sweeps that they did. At step one, they asked Google to identify anybody who had been within a certain distance of that credit union within an hour or so before or after the robbery. That turned up, I believe it was 19 people. There was then a second pass where the police said for a certain number of these users, I think it was all but three of them, or maybe it was all of them, tell us where they were over the course of the afternoon. So expand the geographic scope. By this stage two, all of these people were still anonymous, but the police wanted a broader picture of their movements around the area. Then at phase three, they said, okay, we've got three people out of this set of 19 who we are particularly interested in. Reveal their identities, unmask them, turn their numbers, their IP numbers, over into actual names of people. That is how they ended up identifying Okello Chatry, who they ended up arresting and charging with the offense. So Mr. Chatry moved to suppress that and said, all of this was a search. The government responded, this isn't a search at all. We don't need to argue about how particularized the warrant was or what the probable cause looked like, because none of this was a search for Fourth Amendment purposes. This goes up to the U.S. Supreme Court. The court holds that indeed there was a search. The majority's approach looks to pretty conventional case law here, Katz v. United States, which is a case involving wiretapping of a phone booth back decades ago. Katz is famous because it set out this test of a reasonable expectation of privacy, that the courts are going to look at social expectations. What do people keep private? What do they reasonably expect to be able to keep private in society? And that is the scope of what the Fourth Amendment protects. So the majority here follows a number of cases recently involving cell phones and cell phone location data, and just says, look, the information that you give to Google for your location history is within this expectation of privacy. Justice Gorsuch takes a different tack in his concurrence, and he actually tracks a lot of what we say in our amicus brief, which is courts are not well equipped to assess what is this reasonable expectation of privacy. And indeed, what people expect to be able to keep private depends partly on court decisions. So there's a certain circularity here. It's a bit frustrating. Justice Gorsuch has pointed out in other opinions and pointed out some in his Chatry concurrence, this has led to weird results. The Supreme Court has said things like, you don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy in your garbage once you put it down on the curb for pickup. Your neighbors could paw through it, and therefore so can the police. Gorsuch said, try that and see how your neighbors like that. The government has held that you can fly a helicopter a couple hundred feet above people's property and scan it for what they're growing out back, because that's not within the reasonable expectation of privacy. So again, weird outcomes. Justice Gorsuch said, this is a fool's errand. What we should instead just be asking is, we have constitutional text here. It says that people are protected against unreasonable searches. What does a search mean based on dictionaries at the time of the founding? It means taking intentional actions to reveal something that's hidden. That's it. This is the kind of thing that is hidden. Geolocation data for your cell phone is hidden according to positive law. Within a lot of states, there's a recognition that this is private data. And according to the contract you have with Google and Google's understanding of its clients, this stuff is private. Therefore, getting it involves a search. And then you have dissents as well, which I'll let Kent go into more details because we are running a bit close on time here and I want time to address the other cases as well. So that's Chatry. Moving on from Chatry, we have Abu Ammo. We just celebrated America 250 earlier this month, right there in the Declaration of Independence. One of the complaints about King George is he shipped us overseas to be tried for pretend crimes. Spoiler, King George never actually apparently shipped any colonists to London for trials, but he talked about doing it. He, in fact, revived a statute of King Henry VIII from the 1400s that let royal commissioners set the venue for certain trials, and this caused an uproar. A number of the founders and a number of the different assemblies in the colonies protested that this contravened the common law right of being tried where a crime was committed, which oftentimes is certainly the community affected by a crime. It is also often where the defendant is or is close to, meaning the defendant has easier access to witnesses, to evidence, to counsel, to support from family and friends, things like that. Ancient protection, not one that sees a whole lot of action, until Mr. Abu Ammo's weird little case. Mr. Abu Ammo used to work for the company now known as X, formerly Twitter. He was accused of divulging account information about a Saudi dissident to the Saudi government. Pretty serious national security allegations here. So some agents from the FBI flew up from San Francisco to his Seattle home. Those of you keeping score at home, San Francisco, Northern District of California, Seattle, Western District of Washington. While these agents are interrogating Mr. Abu Ammo, he says, no, I had legitimate reasons for accessing this account information. In fact, I've got an invoice on my computer that I can print off for you guys and give to you. He goes upstairs in his Seattle house while the agents are downstairs in the living room, prints off a piece of paper, hands it to them, and they decide that it is fraudulent, that he made this thing up, that it's a false document meant to obstruct their investigation. They charge him with creating a false document to obstruct an investigation and charge him in the Northern District of California in San Francisco. Their argument is, this is where we were based. This is where the investigation was based. So therefore, we can claim venue in California. The Supreme Court makes quick work of this one. Unanimous decision says, no. Simply because you have tacked an agent on or cited an investigation somewhere doesn't mean you get to pick the venue where you're going to try a defendant. One can imagine other shenanigans the government could do. And our brief argued the government here could just append agents in Washington, D.C. or in New Jersey on every gun control case in the country and drag all the gun people in Oklahoma there for trials. Or you could have abortion cases where the government says, well, this is all going to be investigated out of the Southern District of Mississippi. Go there in front of juries there if you have some sort of dispute around abortion. We think that the slippery slope here was quite considerable. The court unanimously agreed and reversed Mr. Abu Ammo's conviction for improper venue. Moving forward to the Hunter case, Mr. Hunter was convicted of fraud. He entered a guilty plea after the government agreed to drop a whole raft of charges based on various transactions, consolidated it down to just one or two wire fraud charges, and agreed to a maximum sentence that was way below the potential exposure he had, which, as is often the case in these kinds of crimes where you can stack charge upon charge upon charge, went from decades upon decades in federal prison down to a much more modest provision. Mr. Hunter, as federal defendants often do, went to court for his entry of his guilty plea several months before the sentencing hearing and appeared in front of a judge, waived his various rights to trial. In the paperwork that he submitted to the court, he waived his right to appeal anything that the court would impose as a sentence, as well as any other issues that might have come up. In the actual colloquy where he was talking with the judge said, by the way, if you disagree with anything that happens at sentencing, you can still appeal. Your counsel will continue to represent you. And by the way, counsel for both sides, do you have anything to add? The federal prosecutor got up and said, according to the transcript, no, and sat back down. The hearing closed. A couple months later, Mr. Hunter goes back to court for his sentencing. And based on a pretrial report from probation, the judge says, I'm going to require you to take psychiatric medications. Mr. Hunter says, there's this Supreme Court case from the early 1990s that says you can't force me to take psychiatric medications as a condition of my sentence, and I object on constitutional grounds. District court says, tough cookies. He then appeals to the Fifth Circuit and says, I want to do what the judge told me I could do back at the day when I entered my guilty plea. I want to appeal this thing as unconstitutional. Fifth Circuit says, you're out of luck. Your paperwork said that you were waiving your right to appeal. He brings up all kinds of challenges and says, look, I didn't even know what the sentence was going to be. I had no idea here that the judge was going to impose a sentence that I'm arguing is unconstitutional. Fifth Circuit says, nah, you waived your rights. That's it. You're out of luck. That's the end of this. We're dismissing the appeal accordingly. Goes up to the U.S. Supreme Court because there is a circuit split on what an appeal waiver means. No other circuit has gone as far as the Fifth Circuit. A number have an exception for miscarriages of justice and says, look, if you waived your rights and turns out the judge had 12 orangutans try you instead of human beings, or the judge decided to flip a coin and that determines whether or not you're going to prison. That could be a gross injustice that would impugn the judiciary. And so certain circuits have said you can still appeal if something totally off the wall happens. Other circuits have said it depends on a variety of different factors. It depends on how serious of a violation of your rights there was here, if it's a sentence that's not authorized by law, or if the judge takes into account unconstitutional considerations like your race. Like if the judge just decides, you're Latino, I don't like Latinos, so I'm going to give you a 20% surtax on your penalty. Those are the kinds of things that can be appealed. The Supreme Court gets this and says, we're going to go with the manifest injustice approach, the majority approach here. We're not saying what exactly is on one side of that line as opposed to on the other. That's a matter for remand and for the development of jurisprudence. But courts have some experience dealing with, for plain error purposes and elsewhere, what counts as a manifest injustice, as the kind of injustice that brings doubt upon the judicial system as a whole. One of the concurrences says, it's really hard to imagine any unconstitutional sentence, like the one that Mr. Hunter claims happened here, that wouldn't impugn the judiciary. It's really hard to imagine that if the judges are exceeding the bounds of what is constitutional, that that's going to be okay. And by the way, every court, including the Fifth Circuit, has held that if a statute violates the statutory maximum on a punishment, that is the kind of thing that can be appealed. And that was true even under the Fifth Circuit's really narrow reading of what can be appealed in spite of an appeals waiver. The concurrence says, if that's the case, then surely you can appeal an unconstitutional sentence. The majority doesn't go that far. They leave it for consideration on remand. All right. I've been talking for about 12, 15 minutes now. I only covered 3 out of the cases, but we didn't file an amicus brief in Ham. So I will leave that for Mr. Scheidegger's analysis as a matter of first impression. I would be glad to engage on that one as well. But there's our quick take on those 3 cases. And by the way, I should say, we at Cato asked for the court to reach the outcome it did in each of these 3 cases. We're happy campers. We agree more with Justice Gorsuch's approach to the Fourth Amendment in the Chatry case, but nevertheless, we're glad that there's at least some constitutional restrictions that are on the table now that weren't in every circuit before.
Thanks, Matt. Kent, over to you.
Okay. Well, I think as far as the term as a whole goes and the possibilities for future directions, there's more to be seen in how the court decides what to decide than there are the actual decisions themselves. I don't necessarily agree with all that's in the decisions that Matt just went over. I don't find any of them, completely out to lunch. I do worry about the vagueness of the standard in Hunter. I think standards like that end up producing a result that what happens depends more on which judge you draw than does the merits of your case. But that aside, one of the things that bothers me about the Chatry case is the way the court sculpted the question presented to produce a highly artificial decision. Okay, these things are searches. The cops probably knew that because they went and got a search warrant. But do we exclude the evidence despite the fact they have a search warrant? Well, the district court said no, and the court could have easily said, in complete accordance with present jurisprudence, yeah, that's right. That's within the good faith exception. You got the warrant. It wasn't obviously void. Therefore, the exclusionary rule doesn't apply. But even more important than that, our supposedly originalist Supreme Court doesn't show much interest in applying originalism to correct past errors in criminal law the way it does in other areas of law. We've seen bombshell decisions in other areas where the court went back and overruled old precedents that were at odds with the original understanding of the constitutional provisions. We're not seeing that in criminal law. And in the Chatry case, they sculpted the question presented to avoid the elephant in the originalist living room, Map v. Ohio, which found a exclusionary rule within the Fourth Amendment that was not seen anywhere in the first 100 years of that amendment. Those kinds of issues it doesn't seem to be interested in deciding, or at least the majority does not. We also saw an example of, well, let me go back to the term as a whole. I count 17 decisions that were accepted for full briefing and argument. Only three of those were at the behest of the prosecution side or the government side. I'm talking about criminal law cases and law enforcement related civil cases. 14 of them were on the defendant side. They did a little, the law enforcement side did a little better on the merits. They prevailed in 7 of the 17. So it's not quite half, but pretty close. But in the cases that they take, none of them involve really major issues of re-examination of precedents for conformance with the original understanding. The Ham v. Smith case involves one of the wilder departures from original understanding. 2002, the Supreme Court decided that there should be a categorical exception for persons who are mentally retarded, which was the term at the time, or today we say intellectually disabled, from capital punishment. That is certainly a very arguable matter of policy, not necessarily a bad rule, but it has nothing whatever to do with the Eighth Amendment as originally understood. And Ham v. Smith, they take up one of the many, many questions that that decision engendered, which is, how do you actually go about deciding who qualifies for this exclusion? There's a wide variety of opinions. Smith was a guy who had a number of IQ tests, all of which were over the threshold of 70, which is the traditional definition of intellectually disabled. And then this gets into a complex factual question about how you deal with these multiple cases and how you deal with margins of error and so forth. And in the end, the court just throws up its hands and decides, well, we're not going to decide this case. It's a 5-4 decision at that point. Four justices rather strongly dissent, saying they should decide the case. The Court of Appeal was clearly wrong in overriding the state courts and exempting this murderer from the death penalty. But a majority voted to dump the case. Three did not explain their decision. And so we have this anomaly just hanging out there and an unanswered question about how we go about deciding these cases. Only Justice Thomas of the 9 actually says we should go back and re-examine this original decision because it is wrong as a matter of original understanding. It is not in the real Eighth Amendment as enacted by the people. And therefore, we should not be deciding all these questions. We should be leaving these questions to the states where they belong. Looking forward, we have to question whether this trend will continue or whether the court will eventually get around to deciding these kinds of issues in criminal law as it has in other areas of law. I certainly hope so. I hope it's just a matter of criminal law being low on the priority list, as it so often is, and that the court will return to originalism and original understanding as far as criminal procedure and criminal law decisions go. So that's basically my assessment of the term, and hopefully what things will get better in the future.
Well, Ken, thanks. I wanted to follow up for a second on the Ham case, and obviously, I think from it seems your view is that the Eighth Amendment, the prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment, does not application in terms of executing people that are developmentally disabled or below 70 IQ, whatever you want to describe it, and certainly that's from looking at the plain text, that's a credible position. And how do you look at how would you then kind of put it through? There's various factors that the court has used in terms of stare decisis, whether to overturn a prior ruling, even if a majority thinks it was wrongly decided. And obviously, in Roe v. Wade, the majority found there were enough factors on the side of the ledger to reverse it, whereas in other cases, for example, there's probably judges on the court now who disagree with the gay marriage decision, but there's reliance. A lot of people have gotten married and things like that. But there's various other factors, and I'm curious how you think those apply here, number one. And number two, do you think that if the court did reverse a decision, did go back, we got off on the wrong foot on the Eighth Amendment on this, that maybe it's the case, do you think would say, maybe is there an argument that like legislatures would be doing more on this if they, from a policy perspective, but now they just defer to the court because there's this legal precedent?
I think procedure decisions tend to have relatively little reliance interest. Nothing much happens when you overrule a procedure decision. It's just all cases from here on out use the new procedure. As far as state legislatures go, every state but one that has capital punishment has enacted something like the Atkins rule as a statute. And so if those statutes are state law, then state courts can decide how to what the definition is under the statute and how to apply it. And that basically fixes the problem that Atkins set out to fix. What we have now is disputes at the margin of this very gray area, and it's a really unproductive exercise that extends the appeals of these cases for many years, even though there's nothing really wrong with the original decision. The jury under the older rule of Penry has to consider the defendant's mental state for its mitigating force. And if they've already done that, and if the person is on the ragged edge of the categorical cutoff, there's no injustice in not applying the categorical cutoff. So I think very little would change in the trial of criminal capital cases if Atkins were overruled tomorrow. What would change would be the length of the appeals, because it would only need to go through the state courts.
Matthew, did you want to comment at all on Ham or respond to anything else that Ken said?
Sure. I think it also raises questions, though, about the level of abstraction that we apply with originalism. It's obviously the case that we didn't use IQ tests for anything until the late 20th century when they started to exist. Nevertheless, Blackstone's quite clear that the competency of a person at every stage had to be assessed, including whether they were going to be executed. So if you had somebody who developed a severe dementia while imprisoned awaiting execution. They actually couldn't be executed if they didn't understand why they were going to be. So that was true at common law. Now, whether or not that's a constitutional rule under the Eighth Amendment is a fair question, but it's not like this was all entirely just invented out of nowhere by the Warren Court or something like that. Yes, the Eighth Amendment evolving standards of decency test is indeed as squishy as it comes. It's as squishy as this reasonable expectation of privacy notion that I criticized under Katz. But I also want to push back a bit on Kent's characterization of current jurisprudence as perhaps very strongly slanted toward, you know, the bleeding heart side of the spectrum here. Twice this term, the court granted, vacated, and remanded denials of qualified immunity to police officers who were accused of excessive force. It is frustrating when the court takes up a case and then doesn't bother going through the full process, doesn't even give a full reasoned explanation, and kicks things back. Twice, the Supreme Court stepped in to pluck up cases from the courts of appeals, said, these officers were entitled to qualified immunity because there was not a similar enough case presenting the facts of how they may or may not have abused citizens. So go back and do it again, and this time give them immunity. I agree with Kent that this court doesn't seem interested in really getting at the originalism meat and potatoes here. To take the Hunter case for an example here, plea bargaining is now 97% of how convictions are gotten. Up through the early 20th century, it was deemed as a rotten fish that courts should approve under the, if at all, under the most extreme of circumstances. The Constitution not once but twice says that criminal trials shall be by trial by jury. In Article 3, the language is criminal cases shall be tried by jury, not that it's anybody's right, but that this is the mandatory procedure here. And Emma Kaufman has a recent Harvard Law Review article spelling out how this was a jurisdictional requirement for a conviction, not a waivable right at all. And then, of course, the Bill of Rights protects a defendant's right to have a trial by jury as well. In addition, talking about suing government officers, qualified immunity was invented out of whole cloth. It doesn't appear in the text of Section 1983. The original text enacted by Congress said that there would be liability notwithstanding any state common law defenses, and that was omitted by the Reporter of Statutes. So it wasn't until quite late in the game that courts started creating all of these doctrines to shield people from accountability. So, yes, I agree. The court has balked again and again at getting to the real heart of what originalism would require of a criminal justice system and a government accountability system. But that hasn't always been because the Warren Court was particularly friendly to people on the other side of the V from the government. Some of these things are tremendous windfalls for government power here. And in fact, the biggest loser of them all tends to be the community, where juries aren't involved in assessing what sort of conduct should be convicted, what sort of conduct should be punished, and how. The ultimate loser here, more than the prosecution, more than the defense, is oftentimes a jury of ordinary people sitting down and assessing criminally and civilly what we expect of the system.
There certainly is a big difference between what the court does in the summary docket and what it does in the cases it takes for full briefing and argument. I agree with that. And the summary docket is sometimes hard to defend, but I think the full briefing and argument case is pretty much as I've described it. I would love to see fewer plea bargains and even no plea bargains at all. That would be great. I think way too many criminals get off way too easy with their plea bargains. But we would have to greatly increase funding for trial courts, and we would probably need to streamline criminal procedure as well for that to be feasible. So good luck with that.
Well, another option
to see it, it's not going to happen.
Another option, too, is restoring the criminal code to the functions that it historically filled, which was leaving most crimes to the states rather than the federal government and focusing criminal processes on people who offend against the persons, the safety, the property of other people. rather than using it as a tool of remaking everything from addiction problems to mental health, other things like that, restricting it back down to crimes of victims or public order crimes. But those oftentimes were misdemeanors, not the kinds of things that need
in state courts. That's not that much of a change from the present. I mean, most state criminal cases are indeed those kinds of crimes. Federal court, quite different. Yes. What you say is true of federal courts. But as far as the state courts go, it's people committing robberies and, you know, there aren't that many people going into criminal prosecution for possession of drugs anymore. It's crimes against people.
Not into state prisons, but in 4 years as a public defender, I had 800 cases that I was lead counsel on. I will say a huge number of those that required court time and required probation and prosecution resources were for drug possession, gun possession by convicted felons, and that included of any kind, not just violent felons.
Gun possession by convicted felons is a different matter. That does involve real danger to real people.
I would submit that not when it involves simply somebody whose prior conviction was for possessing marijuana or alprazolam, which was a large number of my cases. So I agree with you. It's not that most of those folks are going to state prison. I mean, that's true. But a lot of those folks, that was a very, very large number of the cases that were eating up court resources day in and day out, certainly in the jurisdiction where I practiced and in most of the places that I'm familiar with.
Plea bargaining.
Not so much is really, today.
Oh, go ahead.
No, that's.
It really does separate the U.S. quite a bit from other countries. And in fact, actually, through our State Department over the years, we've encouraged countries to move in our direction. But traditionally, you know, like in Germany, for example, there was some cap, like 15% or 20%, that could be for cooperation and things, but not like where we have, especially with these huge ranges and mandatory minimums, where the threat is if you go to trial, you could have a sentence that's exponentially higher than what you would get through a plea. And that does translate, I think, quite often into people pleading to things they didn't do, and just to avoid that risk.
There are absolutely cases where the defendant should get harsher consequences than they do. And this plea bargaining and this trial aversion that's baked into the system at this point means that there are people who wind up with a long string of misdemeanors and supervision when, frankly, they should be incarcerated because normal members of the community would look at this case and say, this is somebody who's dangerous and needs to be incapacitated, but the incentives are not there to bring that case to trial and then let the judge, and I would argue with jury input, decide what that sentence should be. I agree with you that that does sometimes work out against the interests of the law-abiding public and of the government.
Well, one thing that is a common thread through some of these decisions over the years is a tension between what originalism means in kind of the real world, or even, as you said, kind of the level of specificity with which to, you know, interpret constitutional provisions. So you could compare, for example, what you think about, you know, Gorsuch's jurisprudence on the one hand versus Alito, and others in Chatry, that divergence, but it's also been in a whole bunch of prior cases that we could talk about from previous terms. And, you know, the obviously Alito kind of has more deference to government and puts greater weight on, like, okay, this is what's been done in the past, despite whatever this provision says, and it's been accepted. Whereas kind of Gorsuch tends to like go to what is the original meaning of this provision and let the chips fall where they may. So I'm curious if each of you have comments either, you know, related to Chatry or more broadly on, and by the way, I think there's a summit coming up on originalism, a conference in the criminal law at the University of Ohio, which should be very interesting. And I guess there'll be publications out of that. But when people, a lot of times, just think of originalism and these judges interchangeably, and it couldn't be more different. So I'm just curious.
Well, certainly there are differences, and original understanding doesn't automatically solve all problems, and especially where we're dealing with technology that didn't exist back then. So it's not a cure-all. It doesn't solve all problems. But it is a fundamentally correct way to view constitutional restrictions, in that the original understanding is what the people approved, and the whole basis of judicial review is that the court is enforcing what the people limited the legislature to do, as opposed to making up its own rules and, you know, just deciding what's good policy and engrafting it onto the Constitution, which was pretty much the method for much of the mid 20th century and even into the late 20th century. So that needs to go.
I agree. And I think there's a couple different vectors that are relevant here. First of all, thank you for the shout out to the symposium at Ohio State coming up. My colleague Mike Fox and I will be presenting a paper there on the original meaning of the right to a jury trial as it relates to what we claim as curation of juries in favor of governments. Those papers will be presented in the Ohio State Journal of Criminal Law and the Federal Sentencing Reporter, I imagine, sometime next year. In any event, I want to pick up on Kent's point here and on your point, Mark, which is there are divisions within originalism about these things. I think one of the really relevant ones is Justice Alito takes what we would call the judicial restraint approach, which is unless the Constitution's crystal clear and probably confirmed by consistent historical practice, it is simply silent. And so it's up to legislators and the political branches to figure out what should happen there. Justice Gorsuch takes more of an engaged originalism or judicial engagement approach, which is to say that, look, we have to start like we do with other legal instruments with the text, figure out what that meaning is. That meaning might result in surprises in terms of real world effects. The folks who enacted the Equal Protection Clause in the 1860s almost certainly did not expect it to apply to women, right? That was not the historical practice. It wasn't for some significant period of time afterwards. Nevertheless, that is what the text is that no person shall be denied equal protection. There are a large number of practices around sex and gender that had to fall as that principle's full meaning came to bear. It's not that the meaning evolved. It's that appreciation of what that meaning was grew over time. And I think I would hope we would all agree with that. Even though, yes, no, nobody in the 1860s anticipated it. It wasn't a part of the historical practice at the time. Women were excluded from professions. Indeed, Bradwell v. the Illinois Bar Association a couple of decades later, right, said that women could be excluded from the practice of law because there's no way that's what the Protection Clause meant in terms of expectations. That's what the Supreme Court held. Nevertheless, I think we would all look at that today and say, to heck with the expectations. That's what the text says. It's clearly there. So that is another difference. And by the way, I'm not saying that Justice Alito wants to revisit any of that jurisprudence, but I think it is harder when you're just saying what was the law that was frozen at the time of the decision versus saying, now, what is the meaning that was fixed? That meaning might wind up having broader ramifications. And that's what I think Justice Gorsuch is more open to saying, you know, we have to look at what is the meaning? What does the plain text say? What did it mean when it was enacted? And if that means that we have some surprises in terms of how it works out, that's just the way that it's going to be. So that's another tension in originalism, and it's one scholars are debating quite a bit that's out there. We've also seen Justice Barrett and Justice Thomas tango with each other a couple of times now in opinions about what is the role of history in figuring out that original meaning, especially history after an amendment or a provision passes. Do we look at 40 years of decisions afterwards as shedding light or not? And the two of them have debated this a couple of times in opinions. This is what happens when originalism has kind of won. I don't mean to be too glib about it, but originalism to some extent has cleared the field, at least at the Supreme Court. And so now the debates turn on what is originalism and how does it work? And that's where scholars and judges are turning their attention these days.
I think there is a difference between the Bill of Rights and the 14th Amendment in this regard, as far as what was existing practice at the time, because the Bill of Rights was not actually intended to change anything. It was intended to preserve intact liberties already existing under the law of the time, whereas it was a shield, whereas the 14th Amendment was a sword. It was intended to make change. It was intended to make major change in our society. So the relevance of existing practice at the time, I think, is different in those different enactments.
It could be, and certainly there were justices in the early 20th century who said the level of protection you have against the federal government versus the states is quite different, because the 14th Amendment and the Bill of Rights just have partially overlapping but largely distinct meanings from each other. That's not the way that jurisprudence has developed, but I believe this is working in the background. All of these Second Amendment cases this court has decided lately, justices have taken care to say, whether we look at 1789 or 1787 rather, or, you know, the 1860s, it's the same result. So we don't need to really get into the weeds of how we interpret the history differently if history changed over the course of the 80, 90 years between the founding and Reconstruction. These are all acorns that are left out there for enterprising litigators, though, to make a name on, is to figure out some of those nuances and raise those arguments fresh. We'll see. We didn't talk much about the Second Amendment so far today, but of course, another criminal law opinion that came down toward the end of the term was Hanani v. United States, which was about the federal ban on drug users having guns. The government, speaking of cases the court chooses to take up and designing the case carefully, I really thought that the court and the government were setting up here for an easy win for the government. Mr. Hanani was the test case for whether marijuana users can be disarmed. You can imagine a lot of fairly sympathetic marijuana users. Your veteran, you know, who's trying to ease muscle pain at the end of the day, grandma who's got a CBD or THC subscription somewhere, medical marijuana card out of Florida. They picked Ali Daniel Hanani, who the government alleged, is a terrorist sympathizer, drug dealer who was living with his parents and allegedly had family members who may have attended the funeral for the general Soleimani that we killed in Iraq a couple of years ago. I really thought that this was being teed up for an easy way to avoid the more sympathetic marijuana users in the United States. And yet the court disagreed, and to its great credit, said, look, the government charged Mr. Hanani only for being a marijuana user of some degree and quantity who had a gun in his house. And that's just not enough under the Second Amendment. Of course, the next question that the tidal wave of petitions is going to continue to ask is, what about people who've been convicted of felonies, different kinds of felonies? Do they forever forfeit any constitutional right to keep and bear arms? Can the government, as it does today, continue to charge them with a felony if they ever possess an arm or ammunition again in the future? We've seen some pretty sympathetic fact patterns on that as well. Range, the attorney general a couple of years ago out in the Third Circuit, was a man who was convicted of food stamp fraud in the 1990s, and 25 years later was still not allowed to get a firearm. I am a bit surprised that the court has not granted cert yet. Justice Barrett wrote opinions on this very issue in the Seventh Circuit, saying that she thinks it's unconstitutional to categorically ban all felons for life from having firearms. But keep a close eye on. I think there's a very reasonable chance we're going to have a grant this term or next on that issue.
Yeah, Ken, I don't know if you want to address it. I also know of a case where there was sympathy on the other end. It was a guy hunting turkey in Tennessee. Conviction decades earlier. And of course, there was originally part of the First Step Act would have adjusted, created more flexibility in the sentencing for these felon and gun possession cases to address this, but it didn't have enough support in the Senate, so that provision was dropped. But what are your thoughts on this issue?
The gun laws and the gun sentencing laws are one area where federal sentencing has indeed been too severe and it needs to be moderated. I agree with that. There was kind of a convergence of tough on crime people with anti-gun people in Congress that produced some very surprisingly harsh laws. That said, though, the laws about violence and violent crime and guns have been decimated by Supreme Court decisions and need to be rebuilt because that's something that is very important to keep guns out of the hands of violent criminals and to punish people when they do commit violent crimes with guns. That's the place where being harsh is warranted. Shooting people is something we just have to deal with.
Yeah, and then of course there's the questions of people who are released from a mental institution, you know, for example, who are have been determined really unstable, and that gets into the red flag as well. I don't know, Matt, are you involved in any of that?
Not currently, but I will say there's a spectrum of cases there as well. You, of course, have folks on the red flag law side of things. And by the way, I will say Cato did weigh in Rahimi a couple of years ago about temporary restraining orders, not immediately mental health focus, but some relevance. And Cato's brief just argued that with appropriate procedural due process, there might be ways to temporarily disarm people, but that the Texas scheme there fell short of that. I wasn't personally involved in writing that brief. But on the other end of the spectrum, as far as mental health goes, there was a case out of the Seventh Circuit a few years ago with a man who, I believe it was 20 years prior, had been through a bad divorce, was involuntarily hospitalized for, I believe, about a week, and 20 years later went to apply for a firearm and was denied based on having at some point in his life been involuntarily hospitalized. So I have a disability. I'm a wheelchair user. I'm sympathetic to the argument that disability needs more nuance than just saying, hey, look, at some point in your life, you had some issue. Therefore, kaput, you're forever forbidden from having a firearm. That's not how we treat any other constitutional right. The court's been crystal clear. The Second Amendment is not a second class right. It is disconcerting to me that we still have a jurisprudence that allows for permanent disarmament of a lot of people with no regard to individual circumstances, or to come back to the felony side of things, classes of crimes. It is one thing to have committed attempted murder and gone to prison for 10 years for that. It is another, as a classic law review article about this asks, why can't Martha Stewart have a gun? She went to Camp Cupcake for some paperwork stuff. And yet she is swept in by the same law as John Wayne Gacy, who, you know, preys on communities and goes away for decades. It is too blunt of an instrument for a restriction on a constitutional right. Kent's right. There are drafting issues in a federalism system. The problems that have emerged over and over again at the Supreme Court around felon disarmament have been that Congress has tried to create a federal law that makes it a federal crime for anybody convicted of any state-level offense to carry a firearm. And so that winds up handing the keys over to state legislatures to determine what counts as a crime of violence, what is it that counts as a federal analog. That is a mess. I would argue the federal government has no enumerated power to make that a blanket crime across the country for all contexts. That is indeed appropriate to the states and to interstate compacts to figure out. And that is part of why we have such a problem here, is because the federal government has taken it upon itself to pretend like it's got a general police power around any felon anywhere having a gun or firearms. The court made quick work of this in the United States v. Lopez in the 1990s, when the federal government tried to make all gun possession near schools into a federal crime. And just said, look, this might be reprehensible, even criminally punishable behavior, but what on earth is the federal government doing stepping into this? There are problems with federalism. The rejoinder could be, well, there's all these state prosecutors who do a bad job of things. That's federalism, and that's why we have accountability at the local levels to try to hash things out.
Well, we have only a few minutes left, so I wanted to, we promised we would talk about the Alaska case for the next term, and this is the one with the $95,000 Cessna airplane, I believe, that was seized, 82-year-old pilot. There was alcohol there found, and he was landing. And it's dry. For those of you who know Alaska, you know, there's a lot of places you could only go by plane, by the way. You can't drive. It was literally at the very end of June. But the other, what I was wondering, and maybe one or both of you can answer this, what are the issues in that case? This is, by the way, an appeal from the Alaska Supreme Court, not a circuit court, but is it excessive fines, proportionality, innocent owner, or more than one?
Well, the best textual one would be excessive fines. Mm-hmm. the idea that that there is a proportionality requirement, I think, is not valid. But if you consider a forfeiture to be a fine, then that would certainly be an excessive fine. And so that's a little bit less of a stretch from the language than going the proportionality route.
And Matt, as I understand it, the Alaska Supreme Court's analysis, which ruled in favor of the state, diverged from the Ninth Circuit. But obviously, you can't appeal a state Supreme Court to a circuit court. So we're going straight to the Supreme Court.
Off to the Supreme Court, anytime that there's a split between a state Supreme Court and a circuit governing, Matt, you have one person who, during our planning call, you mentioned this yesterday, Mark, you have one person who's governed by two different standards, and that is a hot mess. When you have the federal court saying one thing, the state court saying another about a federal constitutional provision, that often makes it a bright, shiny object that the court wants to grant review of. I'm glad that they did here. The Supreme Court in the early 90s held that the excessive fines clause applies to civil forfeitures, which I think is absolutely the correct holding here. But it wasn't until about 10, 15 years ago that the Supreme Court held that the excessive fines clause is incorporated through the 14th Amendment against the states. So there's a fair amount of federal precedent on this around the excessive fines clause, but there's limited state precedent. I'm glad that they took this case because to seize a $95,000 plane over a 12-pack of Budweiser's, if we're going to talk about fact patterns that seem to signal what the result might be here, it would surprise me if the court granted this in order to uphold the seizure of this man's plane. I could be wrong. There have been unpleasant surprises before, but I hope that this will give some guidance around what sort of proportionality are we looking at here. What really sealed it for the Alaska Supreme Court was they said, if you look at the social problem of alcohol in dry villages generally, this is a significant social problem, and seizing a plane is proportionate to that. Mr. Zuppi's argument back is that's not how we do this proportionality thing. Otherwise, everything's proportional. If you take an entire country's aggregate problems, anything that a individual owns is going to be proportionate to that. That's not a true limit. It has to be proportionate to what the crime is that this person committed. Certainly, that's how we treat prison terms. It's not like you could have thrown Mr. Zuppi in the slammer for 120 years because drinking up north is real bad. So I am hopeful that the court's going to see this pretty straightforwardly. But straightforward, as Kent and I think agree, isn't always how these cases turn out.
Yeah, and I guess I don't know if it's a strict liability offense that, you know, if he knew that it was a dry county or knew that the beer was there, but that's probably besides the point to what the outcome is going to turn on.
They're arguing that he, in fact, knew. That is a dispute factually. Mm-hmm. The government is claiming that they've got proof that he, in fact, knew that this lady was doing something funky with her luggage and that there was a 6-pack or a 12-pack, but maybe he saw it in there at some point. So I don't think that they're arguing strict liability here, perhaps in part because, man, if you want to talk about an uphill battle, it's probably even more absurd to argue that a strict liability offense should mean you lose a $98,000 plane over, again, a 12-pack of Budweiser's.
Well, we the end of our program today, and I just want to thank both you, Matt and Kent, for doing this. And I think all of the people who have tuned in, as well as those who have a chance to watch it later, will learn a great deal about what the court did this session and how that fits into the broader discussion about criminal justice jurisprudence. So thanks to both of you, and I will turn it back to you, Emma.
Thanks so much. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I just want to thank our experts for the benefit of their time and expertise today. It was a wonderful conversation. I also want to thank our audience for joining and participating. We also welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org if you're interested. And as always, please keep an eye on our website and on your emails for announcements about upcoming virtual events. Thank you all for joining us today, and we are adjourned.
Thanks for listening to FedSoc Forums, a Federalist Society podcast. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you won't miss an episode. To learn more, visit our website, fedsoc.org.